Good morning. It's 9 after 7 on Tuesday, August 12th. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week. Well, it is August, and things are heating up in the Caucasus, a Texas-sized region of mountains, hills, plains, and oil, between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. President Bush and both presidential contenders have criticized Russia's actions in the current conflict going on in Georgia.
I express my grave concern about the disproportionate response of Russia. And that we strongly condemn bombing outside of South Ossetia.
This morning, we'll try to sort through the issues in the conflict in Georgia and provide a clearer picture of what's going on. Of course, the news there is unfolding even as we speak. My guest this hour is Robert Legvold, professor of political science at Columbia University. Professor, good morning. Okay, I don't hear Professor Legvold, so somebody maybe needs to do something. Might even be me, I don't know. At any rate, first of all, let's try to get some idea of the context for this conflict. The Caucasus is a lot like the Balkans, I think, isn't it? Lots of ethnic enclaves and centuries-old enmities. Would that be an accurate analogy?
I hear you now, and I'm back online with you. Yes, it would be accurate to say that the problem in the Caucasus has a long history. It would be wrong to characterize it as simply between Georgia and Russia over the centuries, because that's been a very different kind of relationship if you take it over 100 years. But certainly for the last 15, 20 years after the breakup of the Soviet Union, the relationship has been one of fundamental hostility.
There are the current conflict. Let's try and get some context for that. The South Ossetia and the Georgian government have been at odds, and there's the other breakaway area, let's see, Abkhazia. These are ethnic enclaves. The nature of that conflict is primarily just they've never liked each other, and they still don't.
These are what are regarded as separatist territories that broke away from Georgia. They have historically been a part of Georgia throughout the Soviet period, and indeed during the Imperial Russian period, they had been associated with the Georgian portion of the Russian Empire. But when the Soviet Union came apart, indeed as it was coming apart, there was violence between the central authorities in Georgia and those who local officials in both South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Both territories have other ethnic groups within them, although there has always been a strong mix of Georgians in both South Ossetia and in Abkhazia. But the Ossetians, although they resemble both Russians and in many ways Georgians, are ethnically, linguistically different, and in some parts of Ossetia, among some Ossetians, religiously as well. There are some who are Muslims. Most are Christian. In Abkhazia, it's the same story with the Abkhaz, who at this point were not more than 50% of the population. They were less than that. But nonetheless, with basic tensions between the Abkhaz and the Ossetians, who dominated local government, in violent conflicts, literally civil war, between earlier in the case of South Ossetia, the late 80s, early 90s, in the case of Abkhazia, 92, 93, that finally led to ceasefires, but with the Georgian authority largely pushed out, and with peacekeepers trying to keep the lid on, peacekeepers that included the Russians in both cases. And since then, the Georgians have neuralgically responded to what they see as the loss of territory and the threat to the territorial integrity of Georgia itself.
Well, now, this area is strategically important. Why is that?
It cuts across the northern throat of the Caucasus. You described the Caucasus itself as a region about the size of the state of Texas. It's actually slightly smaller than that. It's between the Black Sea on the west coast and the Caspian Sea on the eastern side. It's a sort of a thick channel that runs down, and cutting across that, just below the Caucasus mountain range that divides Russia from the Caucasus, is Georgia. But Georgia is important not only because it is, in effect, the dominant geophysically portion of the Caucasus, but it also is the key route for exporting energy at the moment, the key route for exporting energy out of the Caspian Sea region, both gas and oil, toward the southern portions around the Black Sea, the only alternative route for Central Asian and Caspian Sea oil and gas runs up into Russia and then down to a Russian port on the Black Sea, and then has to go out through the isthmus in Turkey, through the Dardanelles in the port in that area. So both strategically and for material reasons, Georgia is important.
Well, now you mentioned that the other route to bring oil and gas out of the Caspian area would go through Russia. It would seem to me they would want that, because don't they want to control the flow of energy out of there?
They've been unenthusiastic about a pipeline that runs from the capital of Azerbaijan, Baku, through Georgia, and then down to a port on the Turkish side of the Black Sea called Ceyhan. It's called the Baku-Ceyhan Tbilisi line. But although they had a partial equity in it at the outset, they've given that up. They nonetheless are reconciled to the existence of that pipeline. They've spent more time trying to create alternative gas routes to Europe rather than the one that would run through the southern Caspian Sea, so it's clear they see that as competitive. But this, if the implication of your question is that some of the military action is designed to literally cut that line, that's not so. There were reports on the part of the Georgians that the Russians had launched air attacks near or at the pipeline, but that turned out not to be the case. And I think it would be very foolish for the Russians to have used the war itself to try to physically damage that line. But the Russians are attempting, as a general matter, to give themselves as much a monopoly or at least a dominant control over the energy grid out of the post-Soviet space, including Central Asia and the Caspian Sea, as possible.
We're going to take a break and check weather around the state, and when we come back, we'll ask some people to join us on the phone, and you can be one of them at 800-462-1234 or 263-1890. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. It's 18 after 7. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week. And if you want to continue the discussion about the situation in Georgia, you can join us again at 1 o'clock this afternoon for Talk of the Nation, because that will be the topic of that hour as well. Here, you can join the discussion, and this time I'll give the right and not the dyslexic version of our 800 number. It's 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. In Madison, it's a local call for you. Please use 263-1890, 263-1890. And if you'd like to send us an email, the address is talk@wpr.org. We're talking about the conflict going on in Georgia. And my guest this hour is Robert Legvold, professor of political science at Columbia University. Professor, Georgia really wants to be part of the European Union and NATO. Russia opposes this. How has the Georgian effort to retake South Ossetia and Abkhazia affected its chances of getting into the European Union?
I think the effects are at this stage unpredictable. On the one hand, it doubtless is going to invigorate Georgia's case or effort to prove that it really does need protection against an overbearing and more recently aggressive Russia. And for those within the NATO alliance, beginning with the Estonians and the other two Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, but particularly the Estonians, probably the Poles and some of the other sympathetic NATO nations, plus the United States, that have pushed for an accelerated process of a movement toward NATO for both Ukraine and for Georgia, they'll probably be even more insistent. But it's also likely that for those that have resisted what was the next important step, something called a membership action plan or a MAP for Georgia and Ukraine at the April Bucharest meeting, those who opposed that were the Germans, the Italians, the French, and the Secretary General of NATO. And the indications are that one of the key reasons they did is because they thought that Georgia was a risky proposition, its leadership inclined to take risks, and in these circumstances it would be foolish for NATO to extend a guarantee. It would even be dangerous, and it's likely that when this comes up next, which will be in December of this year, that their resistance is going to be even stronger. And in fact, that was the view of that I was reading recently from a former Italian ambassador to NATO, a man named Sergio Romano, who thought that in the case of the Italians, the French, and the Germans, the effects of this war would be to create obstacles to Georgia's movement toward NATO. The European Union issue is a more complex and distant one, and that's not on the immediate horizon for either country.
And we have some people who want to join us on the phone, and so we'll take some calls. We'll go first to Dan in Reedstown. Dan, good morning.
Good morning. I have just a quick question, or I should say a more fundamental question. The question I've got is something we've seen not just in Georgia but elsewhere over the last generation is these very ethnically diverse areas that had been created into a single identity. In the Balkans, Iraq is the same way. Now Georgia with South Ossetia, like where they were areas that were historically, politically, and ethnically separate, had been forced into this identity of being Georgia. And now the lid, the Russian lid or whatever, is off, and they're trying to separate away. I'm just curious about the history of this sort of thing, and how did South Ossetia and like get in, become identified as, quote, part of Georgia, if there really wasn't any political reason or social reason for that to happen to begin with?
It's somewhat different in the case of Georgia, and indeed throughout the Caucasus, and the listener is quite correct to see this as a chockerboard ethnic mix. It's a real, throughout the Caucasus, including the northern Caucasus that are in Russia itself, it's a real Rubik's Cube of ethnic groups that are different linguistically and sometimes even in religious terms, because there's the influence of the Ottoman Empire and Islam that cuts across the ethnic groups, along with Christianity that goes back to the Byzantine Empire, and then the influence, of course, of the Russian Orthodox Church during the period of Imperial Russia. But it would be wrong to see South Ossetia or Abkhazia as separate territories, say, such as the Kurdish regions within the Middle East, that were then forced artificially into something like Georgia, because there's been a long association that goes back even to the Roman Empire. And at a key point in the Middle Ages, the Ossetians, for example, which were tribes that were along the Don River in Russia, fled the Mongols in that period and fled to the safety behind the Caucasus Mountains, which put them into an area that by the 15th and 16th century was the Georgian Empire. So they were part of that, even though they were separate ethnic groups, for a very long time, and the history of Abkhazia is very much the same. It was the Soviets, when the Bolsheviks took over what was a Menshevik social democratic government in Georgia after the collapse of Imperial Russia, that South Ossetia was again restored to Georgia. There had been violence and conflict between the Georgians under the Menshevik social democratic government in Georgia and the Ossetians, with large numbers of deaths in the late year after the First World War. So the tension between Ossetians and Georgians, that has a long history, but not because they were independent and separate from Georgia for most of the history and artificially forced into Georgia. And as I've said, especially in the case of Abkhazia, this is an area that is about twice the size of the state of Rhode Island. South Ossetia is about the size of the state of Rhode Island. Abkhazia has a population of around 200,000, and fewer than 100,000 of that population are Abkhaz. It's a real mix of Armenians and Russians, and a host of other nationality, or I should say ethnic groups, that most Americans would not have heard of.
Let's go next to John in Madison.
Hello. Yeah, well, it seems to me there's a real double standard here. There was a breakaway area in Serbia called Kosovo that the U.S. and NATO supported in breaking away. But, of course, that was different because Serbia was Russia's ally. And I also remember a disproportionate reaction to something from the Israelis when there was a cross-border raid from Lebanon, and they absolutely savaged that country. $10 to $15 billion worth of damage, 2,000 people killed. My questions are these. What's NATO doing sticking its rear right next to the Soviets, to the Russians? Actually, that's the real problem. They still consider them Soviets. Why is NATO, if the Cold War is over, going in there trying to establish itself? Two, why is the U.S. arming them? And three, what got into the Georgians to attack that town in Ossetia? They killed between 1,200 and 2,000 people with those missiles. I mean, that kind of provocation wouldn't be allowed by any country. If this involved, we were arming, the Russians were arming Mexico, and Mexico suddenly attacked one of our allies, what would we do?
It's your listener is making a very strong statement that has, in some of its elements, merit, but I think it's worth making some distinctions along the lines of the argument. I must say that the broad argument made about the West's complicity in egging the Georgians on, arming them, Russia's legitimate concerns about NATO moving that close to its borders, is very close to Russian sentiments. Much of what he said expresses very well the way this story is being told on Russian television as I watch it. It certainly is the way in which Putin and others around him see the situation. But theirs is also, while it has some merit, it also is a one-sided view. After all, both of these territories, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, are internationally recognized, including by the Russians, as an integral part of the sovereign territory of Georgia. The Russians have not moved to recognize Abkhazia's independence, even though there's been some political pressure within the Russian parliament to do so. And even though the Russians said that the unilateral declaration of independence then recognized by the West in the case of Kosovo created an unfortunate precedent, in some ways would legitimize recognizing territories like Abkhazia, South Ossetia, and a piece of Moldova called Transnistria, they haven't really wanted to move in that direction. The Russians have had a legitimate concern about the potential explosiveness of these so-called frozen conflicts because they are on their border. They do have peacekeepers within each of these territories, and 12,000 of them got caught in the attack on Tsinvali, the capital city in South Ossetia, and died in those circumstances. So the outrage of Russians in that circumstance is entirely understandable. But on the other hand, the Russians, even though they are peacekeepers, even though they have recognized the legitimacy of Georgian sovereignty over these territories, have not really done their level best in order to reconcile the separatist territories with the home territory of Georgia.
We'll have to
in many
that.
Ways,
we'll
they've been an obstacle
that after the
to
news.
Doing so.
Professor, we'll have to finish that response after the news. I'm sorry, we've got to break away and check the news around the state and around the world. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network. At 7:35, you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week. This hour, we're talking about the situation in the Caucasus with the conflict between the Georgians and the South Ossetians and Russia being involved, and lots of controversy over that. My guest is Robert Legvold, professor of political science at Columbia University. Professor, you were in the middle of answering a question when we had to break for news, and if you want to go ahead and pick up where you left off, we'll conclude that, and then we'll go back to the phones. We have more callers who are waiting to join us.
I think the basic point was made. The caller's very strong position on what the West has done to add to the problem, particularly with NATO enlargement and the double standard that's implied, echoes or reflects the Russian position on this. But the Russian position has its own one-sidedness, and that is, as I said, the Russians recognize Georgia's right to the territories of South Ossetia and Abkhazia, even though they know it's a very complicated situation, conflict-ridden. And as peacekeepers and others, they had not done enough in order to prevent what has now occurred. But it is a story where blame goes on both sides, and part of the problem, a large part of the problem, is that all parties, the Georgians, the Russians to begin with, the Ossetians for their part, and the Abkhaz for their part, place 100% of the blame for the problem on the other side. And that's what creates, and that's been true now for some time, that's what creates the basis for where we are now.
Both presidential candidates have been sharply critical of Russia over the past few days for its involvement in this conflict. You say that they're making a mistake. Why is that?
I think it's right and wrong. They're right to argue that Russia has responded disproportionately, and I would go even beyond that, because it looks to me as though the aim, not merely the act itself, the military actions, but the aim of the military actions at this point are what I would regard as illegitimate. They are not to merely restore peace to the conflict zones or protect Russian citizens and peacekeepers, as the Russians claim, but to completely eradicate Georgian influence in these territories and any possibility that it can be reestablished, maybe with the intention of, at some point, annexing at least South Ossetia, because there is an Ossetian portion in the north within Russia, and perhaps recognizing the independence of Abkhazia. That would be illegitimate. On the other hand, to imply that the whole responsibility for how we got here is to the Russians is a mistake. The origination of this is the Georgian attack on Tsingvali, the effort to achieve a mini strategic victory in that area, and the events leading up to this for the last month and before that, the last 9 years, has created a basis for assigning blame to both sides. So to imply that the Russians are entirely responsible for where we are today is a mistake, and the public statements are beginning to suggest that.
Let's take a call next from Bill in Wauwatosa. Bill, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John. Thank you for taking my call. I'd just like to ask the professor whether he thinks we should get militarily involved. Should the United States get militarily involved with another ethnic quagmire there and religious quagmire that's in that area? And should the United States have military forces there if this escalates to a more vicious and rough situation that seems to be continuing? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much, John. You do an excellent job.
Thanks for the call, Bill.
Several things. First of all, I think we are nearing the end of the conflict. That is, I think the Russians are not going to push to occupy Georgia itself. I don't think they're going to continue the operation to overthrow the Saakashvili, that is, the Georgian regime, as some people had feared. I think what they are going to do is entrench themselves in South Ossetia and Abkhazia and create a position of strength for them and their allies. And therefore, I don't think there will be a need for the United States to consider it. Were anyone to consider it, I think it would be a major mistake. But I also don't believe that anyone in the United States or in Brussels at NATO is thinking of doing this. The military involvement of the U.S. to this point goes back to 2000 and 2003 and a decision to provide training for a small brigade of Georgians. It was called by the U.S. It was called the Georgian Training and Equip Program, designed to modernize the Georgian military so they could deal with some of the security problems within their country. That group has then, in fact, joined the U.S. effort in Iraq, and there have been 2,000 Georgian troops in the so-called U.S.-led coalition in Iraq. The Georgians have asked the U.S. to airlift those forces back to Georgia, which the United States has done and is doing. To that degree, the United States is involved militarily. But the implication of the question of the listener's question that we would get more heavily involved or that NATO would, I think, is simply a non-starter. I don't think that is an issue. There's the broader question of whether the U.S. and NATO and the Europeans should engage themselves still more deeply, politically, diplomatically, in backing the Georgians and backing them exclusively in an alignment against Russia. And I think there'll be pressures in the U.S. for some of that to happen. I think that would be a mistake. I think we must continue to try to find some way to bridge that, what is now an enormous gap between Russia and the Georgians.
Well, frankly, Professor, the idea of NATO troops lining up against Russian troops in Georgia is a pretty frightening prospect to me.
It couldn't occur unless Georgia were in NATO, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's going to be very unlikely that there's movement even toward what I earlier referred to as a MAP, the Membership Action Plan, which is a preliminary stage along that path. And even were that accelerated, which I don't expect, it still would be sometime, maybe years, before Georgia could be brought within NATO. So I think any likelihood in the next several years of NATO troops being involved in Georgia is very unlikely. The only way in which you would see some NATO reverberation would be a very indirect and complicated fashion, and that is the so-called Partnership for Peace program that the Ukrainians are a part of and that lead to NATO military, joint Ukrainian-NATO military exercises in the Black Sea and in the Crimea area. And while many of your listeners will not be aware of it, the Ukrainians have now staked a position on the Georgian conflict. And that's because the Russian naval force that's moved down the coast along the Black Sea side of Abkhazia is stationed in the Crimea in Sevastopol, the Ukrainian territory. And the Ukrainians are raising questions about whether they will allow those ships to return to their Russian base in Ukraine.
Okay, well, more and more complications here. Let's take a call from Dave, and we're almost at weather time, so I'll tell you what we're going to do. Dave, we'll take your question, and then we'll have the professor respond to it on the other side of the break. So, Dave, go ahead.
Okay, great, thanks. Your screener asked me, and the professor's already gone through what I had asked, so I'll ask about Georgia's pipeline. This morning, BP closed one of the three major pipelines as a precautionary thing. Now, Russia has attempted to bomb this oil pipeline. What is the significance of the oil lines that travel through Georgia, and what could be the impact of the oil lines being bombed or completely shut off?
And we'll get the professor's response on the other side of a break. I want to give the phone numbers and the email again, because we do have phone lines available for you, and you can call and join our discussion. We're talking about the situation in Georgia, the conflict between the Georgians and the Russians and the South Ossetians and the Abkhazians. It's pretty complicated, but with Professor Legvold's help, we're getting it sorted out. And you can join in with your questions and comments as well. Here's how you do that. The phone numbers are toll-free, 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. In Madison, it's a local call for you, so please use 263-1890, 263-1890. You can also send an email. Here's the address, talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Lines are available now. We'll be taking calls for the rest of the hour, and you're welcome to join us. In the meantime, we'll check the weather around the state of Wisconsin, and then we'll come back and we'll get Professor Legvold's response to Dave's question about oil. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 7:46, you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week. Next hour, we'll talk about the barbarian invasions and how they shaped modern Europe. And we've already hit one thing that'll be discussed next hour, and that is how the Mongol invasions affected Western Europe. And we've already heard something about that in this program. So it's all connected somehow. Just before the break, Professor Dave in Menominee, Michigan, had a question about oil. And you touched on this earlier, but I think given the number of people who probably just joined us since the beginning of the program, it'd be good to review it again, the significance of the oil pipeline across Georgia.
We did talk about it earlier, and to respond directly to Dave's question, I think this is a sensible precautionary measure because this pipeline, the acronym for it is BTC. It stands for Baku Tbilisi Ceyhan, and the T is the issue. It's Tbilisi. The Russians, in the last several days, have bombed near Tbilisi, indeed have bombed the international airport around Tbilisi, and then some military air facilities or military facilities in that region. And therefore, the precautionary measure makes sense. There had been earlier reports that the Russians had attempted to bomb BTC. That was from the Georgian side. They were never confirmed, and I think it's very unlikely. Secondly, because the military operation, as President Medvedev has now announced, is concluded, and it remains to sign a formal ceasefire, the French president's in Moscow now, seeing if they can work out that detail, the Russians have permitted themselves what might be called sort of continuing mop-up operations in the region, and some of their forces are still beyond the border of South Ossetia and the southern side of Abkhazia, but I do not expect further major military attacks, air attacks, in that region that would endanger the pipeline.
Okay, Dave, thanks for the call. 800-642-1234 and 263-1890. Still a line available for you if you call right now. We'll go next to Mike in Milwaukee.
Hello?
Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air.
Morning, Professor.
Good morning. I have a question.
Since day one, everybody's condemning Russia, media and all the leaders. How come nobody said anything about Georgia starting it? And nobody, even George Bush yesterday said that it's 21st century, there shouldn't be happening that kind of thing. But he forgot that Iraq thing happened in 21st century also.
Well, Mike, there are two parts to your question. One, the extent to the second part is what right does the United States to have to call the kettle black after what we've done in Iraq, and the Russians certainly have used that as a further justification for the kinds of things they've done. But on the specific issue, I think there are a number of commentators, and if one reads the press carefully, who recognize, and governments as well in Europe and even the United States have suggested, that the Georgians do bear some important responsibility for this explosion of tension in the area because of the attacks on Tsingvali. It didn't just begin with the attack on Tsingvali this past week. There have been escalating military skirmishes both in Abkhazia and in South Ossetia for more than a month now. Indeed, there were three other occasions when there were artillery attacks on Tsingvali from the Georgian side. And I think most people recognize that. There's been an awareness that the Georgians have pushed the issue in the context of tit-for-tat military skirmishing, as I've said. And there, I think, is even a recognition that what was done in Tsingvali was a major miscalculation on the part of Saakashvili and his people. But the reaction that you're seeing now, which appears to be so directed against the Russians, is what the Russians have done after the start of the conflict, and that is the degree to which they've escalated the military conflict, and as I've added now, the aims that they appear to be pursuing at this point, as opposed to the aims that they could pursue earlier, which probably did have to do with keeping a lid on, keeping the peace, some kind of stability in regions that, after all, are on their border. But now it looks as though they may be putting themselves in a position to go beyond that.
And, Mike, thanks for that call. We have an email from Jim in Madison who says, regarding the recent crisis in Georgia and South Ossetia, I see the U.S. media simply mischaracterizing it as Russia wanting total monopoly with Caspian oil and gas. The BTC pipeline is somewhat of a failure because it is running at below full capacity because the Russians have simply contracted to ship most of the Caspian oil and gas. In any case, Russia already has a near monopoly with supplying Europe. Hence, Georgia does not really matter when it comes to energy supplies and transport. The real problem is Georgian President Saakashvili, who is increasingly seen as mercurial and as a loose cannon. I think a hefty necktie awaits him at a Tbilisi public square. That's an email from Jim in Madison. Well, I think he's agreeing with something you've already said there as far as Mr. Saakashvili as being seen as kind of a loose cannon.
Well, if one were to characterize President Saakashvili, I think there are certainly elements of intemperateness on his part, of willfulness. It's not to suggest, however, that the man is irrational. He may be, and those around him, because the attitude, which is very, very anti-Russian, and you've seen it in his public statements, is shared by a very broad segment of the Georgian population, certainly the political elite. So he's not unusual in this extraordinarily harsh attitude toward the Russians, and the Russians reciprocate with an equally harsh attitude toward him. On the author of the email's point about energy and the relative unimportance of Georgia in the caucuses, that's not entirely correct. We do see Caspian Sea oil and gas as it passes through the Caucasus, and the oil passes through Georgia and the gas potentially through southern Georgia, as an important part of diversification of supply to Europe and elsewhere, so that Europe is not utterly dependent on Russia. And even though the email writer is correct in saying that BTC is struggling to be commercially viable, that's in its early phases. BP, when it made its original decisions, calculated that in the long run it's likely to be more successful. So it would be wrong to dismiss the importance of the area, but the writer is absolutely correct to say that oil and gas would not be the reason for this war or for Russia's actions.
We are nearing the end of the program. Let's go to, let's take Orville in Madison. Orville, good morning.
Good morning. I'd like the professor to comment on Putin's and Medvedev's characterization of Georgia's action as genocidal. They're both saying, this is genocide.
Well, here we get back to a concrete illustration or elaboration of the point I made earlier, that all sides, Georgians, Russians, Ossetians, Abkhaz, blame the other side for 100% of what's going on. The Georgian characterization of this is that Russia can't stand to live next to a democratic Georgia that protects and respects freedoms, and therefore it's determined to destabilize the country and maybe overthrow the regime, and therefore Georgia now under attack looks like Poland in 1938 or Afghanistan in 1979. The Russian side of this story is that the Georgians have engaged in ethnic cleansing, that indeed they ought to be brought before a war crimes tribunal. As I watch the Russian news, they've sent a portion of their, what we would call our Department of Justice, their prosecutor general, a portion of that office down to Ossetia to begin investigating the basis for what they see as war crimes, what they call ethnic cleansing. But the Russians have also called what they see as discrimination against Russians in Estonia and Latvia, which is not at all violent, maybe discriminatory. They've called that ethnic cleansing. So countries throw these terms around rather loosely. And as I say, that's part of the problem. Rather than saying that this is an interaction, that this has been a spiral of tensions, we've got to find a way to sort this out because neither side is entirely right or entirely wrong, the problem is that they see the other side as entirely responsible.
We're going to take a last call from Mike in Appleton. We only have a couple minutes left, so everybody's going to have to be concise. Mike, go ahead.
I'd like the professor to take a step back and perhaps take a wider view. And it seems to me that we're seeing in Russia a resurgence of their wanting to become a superpower again. And I think in a relatively short period of time, historically speaking, we're going to see the world dividing into three large blocks: Europe dominated by the Russians, the Far East dominated by the Chinese, and then the Americas dominated by the United States.
Okay, let's let the professor get a chance to respond. Good closing question.
Well, I would disagree with the concluding point that that's the way the world is going to divide up in the longer run. The basic point that Russia is back, whether as a superpower is another matter, but that it's back as a major player in international politics. It's been determined to do so using its energy power, and now throwing its military weight around is absolutely correct. And in some cases, this is payback or, if you will, an indulgence satisfying themselves for the humiliation of loss of empire and what they saw as the treatment as a junior partner by the West in the 1990s. So there's no question that emotion, prestige, standing is an important part of what they're doing. And most of us in the business have recognized that Russia is back and has to be dealt with as a serious player for some time.
Well, Professor, we have about 30 seconds left. If you were going to give one piece of advice to either President Bush or whoever follows him, what would it be?
stand back and look long and hard at what's going on in the relationship. Don't act hastily in the context of these events, because on both the Russian side, the U.S. side, and the European side, there is the potential to do enormous damage to the overall Russia relationship with Europe and the United States at a time when we have to work together on nuclear issues, both nuclear weapons holding states, non-proliferation, climate change, energy security, and stability in this vast region so key to East Asia, Europe, and the unstable Islamic South. So the stakes are very high. Keep a cool head. Don't react intemperately or impetuously.
Professor, thank you so much for the educational hour.
You're welcome. Good luck to all of you.
Robert Legvold is professor of political science at Columbia University. Rob Ferret produced this program with on-air production by Michelle Kofel and Cynthia Schuster. If you would like to hear the program again, you can go to the website WPR.org and listen to it all over again. If you were a member of the WPRA, you could download the program. Or you can call the radio store at 800-747-7444 and ask for a copy of program 812B. The barbarian invasions next, coming up after the news. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.